Nice to be here again, and hope everybody's doing well. 72 babies, Doug. Impressive. A burglar entered a home to burgle. I guess that's a verb. I'm not sure. A burgle, and he's burgling, and it's dark, and it's 2 a.m., and he's stealing stuff. That's what they do. He's stealing. Silverware, and he's stealing electronics and all this. And he's in the living room, and it's dark, and he's having a great time, and all of a sudden, he hears a voice behind him. And the voice says, "Jesus is watching you." And he goes, "That's really weird." He keeps working, hears the voice again. "Jesus is watching you." He didn't get it, but he has a flashlight. So he turns the flashlight around, and right behind him, in the living room, is a birdcage. And in the birdcage is a parrot. And he shines the light in the parrot and says, "Did you say that?" And the parrot goes, "Yeah." He says, "Are you Jesus?" The parrot goes, "No. I'm Moses." Well, now he's really confused. You know, do I need meds or what's this about? He says, "You're Moses?" And the parrot says, "Yeah." He says, "You're not Jesus." The parrot says, "No, I'm Moses." He says, "I am really confused here. What kind of dysfunctional family would name their parrot Moses?" The parrot says, "I'm not sure. Probably the same one that would name their Rottweiler Jesus." There's a kind of a point there, and it has to do with our talk today. In the metaphor is that sometimes when you're with your people that you're leading, either the leadership you're developing or the people, just kind of the attendees who are looking to you, you don't know who to be. What's going to turn them on? Do I need to be Moses or Jesus or a parrot or a burglar? Or what is it going to take? Because different people are drawn by different things. Let me ask you guys a question. I want you to think for a second and reflect on somebody that you, nobody's in this room that hasn't been led by somebody. I have several people that have kind of formed my life over the years. I'm very, very grateful to. But think about somebody that led you well. It might be a pastor, a spiritual director, a teacher, an athletics coach, somebody. But you were drawn to that person. You didn't have to just show up at their class, at their discipleship course, at their seminary course, or at their, you know, the football field. You wanted to be there. And I want us just to kind of call that. I always believe it's good to say it. When you say it, things happen inside that are good. So what did this person have that made you want to follow them? Anybody? They had enthusiasm. It's huge. Good. Integrity?
Principles?
You were drawn to the principles, a person living by principle. Vision.
Authenticity,
who they really were. They showed they care. You know, people come to church sometimes because they ought to. The law is still within us. But the people that really, when you look at Willow Creek's Reveal study, you know, that kind of changed the way we all look at church growth, is there is the ought to. We're supposed to. It's a command. But there's also the want to. And leadership as a minister or pastor in whatever, you know, space you're in, senior, executive, junior high, evangelism, discipleship, all the stuff you guys do, you will find the best fruit when your people want to be there and they want to follow you. So what are we going to do is I've got some fresh stuff here that's based on just kind of my observations of leaders. I think my little microphone is falling off my ear, isn't it? Is it just kind of, yeah. Leaders are imperfect people. I just joke because of the, that's okay. And I wanted to give you basically as a takeaway, I want you to have five things in your toolkit. I just want to give you five simple, doable things that will help you to have people drawn to you so they want to be with you. And they're productive with you and good things happen. So I want you to look at this talk with two lenses. Lens number one is your leaders, because I believe that the best use of your time in church growth and discipleship and everything is investing in your leaders, because your leaders will invest in leaders who will invest in leaders. But so look at it by, you know, maybe it's your executive team or maybe it's the volunteers you have or whoever, but who are you leading and how will these affect that? The second lens is just the people that are coming to church. Non-Christians, searchers, halfway disciples, kind of checking things out, church hoppers, but how this attracts that. And if you look at those five principles with both lenses, you'll be able to come away with some real practical things to help things get better. All right? So that's where we're going to go. And then Jim said he wanted some time for questions and answers afterwards, and we can really do that, and I think that's sometimes a really helpful thing to do. By the way, a lot of you guys don't know each other when we get to the QA period. And, you know, we're Christians, so we're all shame-based. And since we are, and you have to raise your hand and say, I've got a problem with so-and-so, you don't have to do that here. Jim and I have worked this out. You raise your hand and say, I have a friend with a problem, and I'll write down the answer. Please pray for my friend. They're kind of screwed up. They have some issues. And it'll be a great day, so it's a safe place. Okay? Kind of the positioning passage here is in Matthew 5, where Jesus said one of those statements that kind of has stayed with us for thousands of years, verse 14. He says, you're the light of the world. He's talking to the disciples. He's talking to us. You're the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. And he was talking about the fact that we shouldn't be afraid of the faith or ashamed of the faith and the gospel and so on and so forth. But he's also talking about the nature of light. Now, what is light for? God, you know, God invented light, and light has a purpose. God doesn't do accidents. What's light for? Sorry? It illuminates things. It makes things visible that are not visible. So we have clarity. And one of the things, the implications exegetically that he's saying about this word is that light draws people. Light draws people. In fact, when you show your gifts and your personality and your character and your principles and all these sorts of things, people are drawn to you. Now, some people are going to be drawn away from you. You know, we found that in John chapter 1 when it says that darkness did not comprehend the light of Jesus. But light sort of forces a decision. Light either forces you to say, I want more of that gal, I want less of that gal or guy, or I can't stay neutral. That's the good thing about light. God's always into commitment. And so look at this talk as, how do I become the light that God designed in me and develop that part so that people have to make a decision? I really like the fact that they're truthful and they're honest and they have great grace and they love people and they have standards. And some people might say, I don't like that. This kind of standards thing is kind of not my bag, and you have to make a decision. But that's good. All right. So we'll take it from there. And kind of the positioning kind of motivation is that the more you learn these five principles, the more you will keep your rock stars. Your rock stars are the ones that they have the talent, they have the character, they have the maturity, and they want to be around a person who draws them. Rock stars don't show up and say, well, I'm in this church because I believe in the mission, it's my denomination, but I really don't get along with the leader. They don't have to do that, honestly. There's a market out there that will take them somewhere else. So if you want to keep your rock stars, you need to develop these things so that they're there for the mission, your mission, the one on your website, they're there for the mission, but they're also there because they are drawn to you and they want more of you. Your B players and your C players and the people that aren't very competent and not very motivated, they'll probably hang out. But they will not make you, as Jim referred to, they will not make you the church that the gates of hell cannot stand up against. It's your rock stars, high competence, high character, high spiritual maturity that you really want to make sure are drawn to you. So these are the pieces. The first one, everybody got an outline? Okay, we just finished the introduction section. See, I am very sensitive to left brain thinking. Everybody know the difference between your left brain and your right brain? Left brainers are going like, where is he right now? Is he off the topic already? Oh my gosh, my day's ruined. Oh, what am I doing? You know, you're kind of like depressed and everything. But we're going to take care of you left brainers. We have just finished the introduction. We're going to point one. God is in his heaven. It's a wonderful day. You right brainers, you don't care. You're creative and emotional and sort of non-structured and spontaneous. Right now you're going, do unicorns really exist? Is John going to answer that today for me? We'll help both sides of your brain. God made both of them, but we are just finishing the introduction section. So the first one is personal warmth. Personal warmth. One thing you find about leadership research, and this is kind of the coolest part of, I'm a research junkie, is that leadership research, when it's done right, double-blind studies and big numbers and all that, when you do the right kind of methodology and leadership research, I have never seen it fail to support the scriptures. I just love that about the research. Because if it's done right, it invariably it will say God was right. Because I love it when God finally gets some credit for the things he said for thousands of years. And one of the things the leadership talks about is how important it is to be a warm person. And then you look at things like how a soft answer turns away wrath and comfort one another with the comfort with which we've been comforted. Warmth. Well, let me kind of talk about warmth a bit. In my world, the world of shrinkdom, that could talk about empathy skills, listening skills and empathy skills. Now, a lot of you guys have had a lot of, you know, courses and maybe grad school and this sort of thing on empathy. What is empathy? Feeling what somebody else feels. It's an emotional thing. Do you know that what we're finding out is that you really can't know somebody until you know their feelings? You can have lunch with them and know that they like the Lakers or hate the Lakers, or how Calvinistic are they really, and how many kids they got, and how many dogs, and where they went on the vacation. But until you know your feelings, you don't know them. Have you ever had lunch with somebody, and you knew all this stuff, but you didn't know how they felt, and you thought, the lights are on, but nobody's home here. And nice person, but they're sort of like this granite thing, and I can't get past them. That's because God designed it, that warmth draws us to each other. And one of the things we found out in really effective leaders is that they take initiative to move inside the world of other people. Let me say that again. They take initiative to move inside the world of other people. See, we're all leaders. And most of my work is with the corporate world and training executives and training teams. And I'm sorry, but we all just talk too much. We talk too much. And here's the funny thing. God built in a ratio in our brains. You know, how many ears do you have? I'm not trying to trick anybody. How many ears do you have? Jim told me this is the brightest group he's ever had. So how many ears? 2 ears, right. How many mouths do we have? The ratio is significant. But we don't. We always have these nuggets and we want to challenge and give 4 points and all this. And do you know what happens when we talk too much to our people we're trying to train? I study neurology. After a certain point, when somebody's like lecturing to you about 4 points about how do you live your life, you know what the brain actually does? It goes to sleep. It just checks out. They did the electrode stuff on the people's heads, and the same patterns when some leader is giving 14 golden nuggets of value and REM, sleepy by, they're the same pattern. So you're sitting there having lunch talking to these people about how they ought to live, and they're like this, and they're going, love you. Warmth is the other way around. Warmth is listening. I'll give an example. I come from a fairly large family. Got 3 sisters. I mean, I grew up with a strong mother, 3 strong sisters, and I have a strong wife. I mean, I'm trained. That's worked. So we're all from the East Coast, and so I always take my wife and kids to the West. Wait a minute. We're on the West Coast here. I take them to the East Coast to do the Christmas thing. Everybody has a great time. And so I'm there recently, and one of my nephews, no, I don't have any nephews yet, I have a niece. My niece, Lindsay, she comes up and she says, Uncle John, can I talk to you? I said, sure, Lindsay, what's going on? She said, I got some problems. I said, I'm sorry, what's going on? She says, I'm a senior in college, and I'm a sociology major. And that's a problem. They're not banging on my door. And my boyfriend and I broke up, and that's really hard because I miss him and I feel bad. And also, I'm not sure where I am with God anymore. I'm really questioning my faith. And goodness gracious, I felt so much compassion because I remember the 20s. They weren't fun years for me. There were all the angst, and what do you think? How many had a tough time in their 20s, right? If you didn't raise your hand, you're in denial, and praise God, that's fine. But 20s were tough. And so my heart went out to Lindsay, and I said, well, what can I do? She says, well, you got to fix my mother. My sister. I got to fix Susan, my sister, her mother. I said, I'm kind of off the clock. She goes, you're here. You got to fix her. I said, what's going on with Susan? Now, by the way, I've got permission. Susan is glad to hear the story. I'm not triangulating or gossiping. She says, well, she's kind of weird with this. And I said, what's that mean? She goes, well, every time I tell her about how it's a struggle with the job thing and the boyfriend thing and the God thing, she says, Lindsay, you're a Christian and you're smart and you're pretty. Feel better. You ever had somebody do that? Feel better now. And I go, that's like bizarre. She goes, yeah, tell me about it. It's my mother. I said, so what do you do with your mom? She goes, well, I just avoid her. I just don't talk to her anymore. I said, well, that's horrible. Well, what do you do with your dad? My brother-in-law, Mark. She goes, oh, I talk to him all the time. It's great. So I'm going, okay, now we've got a baseline here. Somebody's connecting, somebody's not connecting. So I grabbed my sister. You ever do those family reunions where everybody's having their little kibitzing meetings in different parts of the house? You know, we'll talk in the kitchen here. We'll talk in the backyard. We'll go to the master bedroom, and everybody's doing all this stuff. And it's kind of like that. I mean, I'm miserable. And I get with my sister, and I said, so sounds like Lindsay's struggling. She goes, oh, she's really struggling. You got to fix her. Tell me what I should fix. Well, if she might have told you, she has a job problem, a boyfriend problem, and a God problem. And so will you fix her? And I said, well, sounds like her struggle is also with you. She says, I know, fix that too. I said, well, what she tells me is that you tell her that she's Christian, smart, and pretty, and that's not working. She says, make it work. Make her feel. It's like when somebody comes up and says, Romans 8:28. He's sovereign, okay, you know, and you just feel like the angels are singing. You feel kumbaya when they say that, don't you feel like? They want to take a jackhammer to your head and put the verse in. And I go, okay, she says she's not listening to you. She says she's not listening to me. And I said, I think I need to switch to a metaphor here because my linear conversation with my sister is not going well. I said, look at it this way, Susan. Lindsay fell down a well. 40-foot well. Just boom. It's the well of no job, no boyfriend, where's God? And she's at the bottom of this well. And she's cold, and she's dark, and she's damp, and she's lost, and it's awful. It's just awful. And you're at the top of the well in the bright sunshine, and you're leaning over saying, what? You're Christian, and you're smart, and you're pretty. Feel better. And I said, she shut you down. I said, your husband jumps into the well. I get a little emotional in this part. Mark jumps into the well, and he lands that 40 feet down, and he looks around at how dark and cold and scary it is, and he picks up his daughter, and he holds her. Parents hold their kids. And he says to his daughter, it is scary, and it is dark, and it is confusing, and the job thing and the God thing and the boyfriend thing are really, really awful problems. And I've got you. And I get it. And we'll stay here and we'll come out when you're ready to come out. So my sister's listening to that. And she goes, you're telling me to jump in the well. I said, I am. You're a mom. She said, this is hard for me. I said, I know. You're an advice giver. She goes, I know. I want to give her nuggets of encouragement, and I want to be her cheerleader and tell her that God's in charge and all that. And it's hard for me to just jump in the well. I said, I know who your parents are. Don't worry about it. I said, but you're a mom. You got to do this. And I said, Susan, advice is great. The Bible has all these passages about, you know, wisdom and feedback and truth. But basically, if you're a... She is a consummate advice giver. You have to earn it. There's a sequence to this. If you look in John 1, it says grace and truth came through Jesus. And if you look in the Greek, it's syntactically, the order is significant. It's not just random where God flipped a coin and said, I could have said truth and grace. Grace and truth came through Jesus. Grace is the well. Grace is the warmth. Grace is the empathy. Grace is the listening. Truth is the reality, the answers, the solutions, the challenges. And I said, you're not earning it. And she's cut you off. So she said, what do I do? I said, what every advice giver in the world has to do, put duct tape on your mouth and just say things like, tell me more about it. Sound like that was hard. How'd that feel? That sounds discouraging. That sounds scary. And I can just see my sister going into anxiety. I know, but she's Christian, smart, and pretty. She's Christian. I said, we'll get to that. But there's a sequence in God's way of having good relationships. She goes, okay. So I checked with her, I don't know, 6 weeks later, and Lindsay goes, we're fine. Susan says, we're fine, and she did it. And they're doing great now. But translate that into your office. Because we don't like to sometimes hear bad news. So when we check in on our, like a lot of pastors and leaders and CEOs, you'll check in with your troops on Monday to see how the weekend was. And I've been with CEOs that have done this. I'll kind of shadow them. And they'll go up to, you know, so-and-so on Monday and say, how's the weekend? And the person will go, yeah, it was okay. Great, great, great. Good to hear. How was your weekend? It's all right. Oh, fantastic. Glad to hear that. You know, and you know, in their head, they're just checking this, I've been a good leader checkoff thing. Instead of, well, that doesn't sound okay. Well, you know, we had a tough week. We got a kid who's sick and we've been to four doctors. We don't know what to do. And it's been a horrible weekend. Well, tell me more about that. And you do the 7-minute counseling session every pastor, every leader must do. You can't be their counselor, but you can give them the 7 minutes of connection and support and resources. That's what warmth is. But if you're an advice giver, and probably 80% of the leaders I've ever worked with in the last 25 years have been advice givers, earn it. We need your truth. But you must earn it by jumping in the well by warmth. The second one is a thing called vision alignment. And vision alignment has to do with the fact that one of the aspects of a leader that's sort of unique to the leader, because leaders have lots of roles and things they have to do, is that you must be the person that guards the vision. It may be the vision of your church, if you're the senior person or executive person. It may be the vision of your department or division or business or whatever. But only the leader can guard the vision. You've got to be sort of the pit bull that says, is the vision being followed? And the term vision alignment is a technical term in business, which means, is every part of that organizational chart, and you must be thinking about organizational charts. You've got to have one in your head and written down somewhere. Is every part of that organizational chart have a person that knows how what they do ties into the vision? In my world, we call that line of sight. Line of sight means that not only do your higher level professional people with master's degrees, do they know what they do that contributes to the vision, but also do the people who are, you know, minimum wage, sweeping the floor, cleaning up on Saturday and Sundays, do they know what it is? And you know what happens? Is we assume that people understand. They don't. They're busy, they got lives, they got kids, they've got heartbreaks, they've got challenges, and it's our job to over-communicate the vision to them all the time. That's what vision alignment is. One of the things that I found really helpful, how many of you have like some kind of weekly meeting? Team meeting, exec meeting, whatever? Okay. And basically it's kind of like, here's what's going on, here's the crises, here's the challenges, here's the long-term stuff, that sort of thing. One of the things I found really, really helpful, either in a company or a church, is for you to begin every meeting with, here's what we're about. The phrase, here's what we're about. And then say what the vision is. And to trade that off week after week. So if you've got 8 people you meet with, number 2, week 3, in 8 weeks, everybody says it. What we found out in neuroscience is if you say things, you feel things, and if you feel things, you own things. If you say them in community, then you feel them, and if you feel them, you own them. And all of a sudden, that vision becomes alive. And so, let me just try it out. Because every one of you, there's a website somewhere with a vision that you're owning, right? What is the vision of your organization? Just, I'd love to hear a few of these.
Helping people who are saying no, say yes.
Helping people who are saying no, say yes. What kind of organization are you in? So saying no to God, say yes to God, that sort of thing? Is that the idea? That's really good. That's really good. People whose lives aren't involved with God saying yes to God. Very simple and thought-provoking. Good. Somebody else. Yeah.
Bring a living Jesus to a dying world.
Bring a living Jesus to a dying world. It's quick. It's emotional. It grabs you. I love that. Somebody else. One more.
Transforming ordinary people.
Did you hear that? I can't say it. Transforming ordinary people into passionate followers of Jesus who feels the change in the world. Love that. Let me ask you a question. If the people you're leading, training, mentoring, discipling were here, and I said that, my sort of, you know, educated random guess is probably 40% of them could do what you just did. Why is that? Because people are busy. And we're all kind of ADD these days. Squirrel! You know, we're all just busy. We're overwhelmed. We've got a million things to do. We live in a tech age. Whose job is it to continue over-communicating what we're about to your people? It's my job. So, I always find it fun to not say, hey, next week when we meet, I'm going to ask you to say their vision. If you know it or not, what are they going to do? It'd be like when they were in high school, they're going to cram, right? So glad you asked, Pastor. Our vision is, you know, just bring it up. I've been really thinking about what's important. I know we've got so many things going on. We've got financial issues. We've got personnel issues. And there's a crazy couple that's driving us crazy or whatever. But I've been thinking about what's important. And I need for us to own this because we need that big, big, big picture first. And just say, who can say it? And then when everybody gets over the awkwardness of, oh, I haven't checked the website in a year, you've done a good job. Only we can do it. See, leaders get caught doing things that other people should do, right? Or can do. That's why there's so many boundaries books out there by that guy. And leaders need to start doing what only they can do, and you are the guardian. You are the pit bull of that vision. Bring it up a lot. Bug people about it. Make sure they know it. Ask them what they mean. And the guy and the volunteer that's helping with the three-year-olds, see if they can know why what they're doing once a week ties in the vision. Only you can do that. Right? And people are so drawn to that. They're so drawn to that. Because otherwise, they go in the weeds and they do busy work and they're kind of like, what's this all about? You're the one that says, basically what we would say in our faith is transcendence. I'm showing you transcendence. That the way you take care of those babies adds to our vision. The way you clean up the floor adds to the vision. The way you do great music with your guitar on Sundays adds to the vision. The third thing is vulnerability. And vulnerability has to do with one of the hardest things for a leader. And that's to show your weaknesses. There's two aspects of vulnerability. One is need and one is failure. Vulnerable people are comfortable talking about what they need, and they're also comfortable talking about their failure, and they don't mind bringing it up in a relationship. And this is very, very difficult for a high-performing, alpha, kind of driven leader. We are not comfortable being vulnerable in front of our troops, the people we're training, or in front of our flock. And let me just kind of process this for a second. There are lots of reasons for that, but it's good to talk about it. Why is it so hard for us to be vulnerable? I don't mean at home with our support group, or I've also said our spouse. I get that. Why is it hard for us to be vulnerable with the people we're leading, training, and all that? There's some really valid reasons.
Familiarity breeds contempt.
Because the feeling of familiarity breeding contempt. If I show you parts of me that are difficult, well, you might not respect me, and I need you to respect me because I'm a leader. Good. Somebody else.
Pride.
I just don't like to open the kimono. It's just I'd rather you see me as a good person. I'm kind of ever since Genesis 3, right?
Unaccepted.
I might be unaccepted. It might really go bad that I kind of show what's difficult about me. One more.
Ego.
Right. Here's what's funny about this. This is one of those really cool counterintuitive research things that shows a point that you would not think was true. They compared, bulletproof leaders. Anybody ever fly out of John Wayne Airport recently? Who's the statue? I just kind of gave you a little 12-foot statue of John Wayne. Really vulnerable guy, you know, really open about his knee. No, John Wayne is the icon of bulletproof, right? I've got it together, I'm self-sufficient. Lots of character, lots of integrity, but vulnerable? No. Okay, so they studied that figure, you know, the bulletproof, I've got it together, and they studied the vulnerable leader. Both of them high capacity. Both of them talented, smart, driven by good values. But one was not open about weaknesses. And the thinking in the study was, well, people would certainly be drawn to bulletproof because people need somebody to identify with. Like not identify with, but to be, aspire to. I want to aspire to be like that, XYZ. Results were totally the opposite. They were drawn to the vulnerable leader who talked about his or her needs and talked about his or her failures. Needs, failures, needs, failures, needs. It's a counterintuitive study, so a very valuable study. Why do you think people were more drawn to the vulnerable leader? There's some really good reasons.
They could relate.
The principle of aspiration, I want to be like them, they've got it together, they have a 2-hour quiet time in India every day and I don't, you know. And their marriage is perfect and their kids don't have zits and it's really good, you know. That aspirational thing is nowhere near as powerful as the identification principle. Identification beats aspiration. And think about Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15. He says, we have a Savior who suffered in every way as we do, yet without sin. Right. That's why we are what we are, and that's why we follow who we follow. Because we have the unique faith where God didn't say, come be like me. He said, if you want to do that, I'm coming down your way first. I'm going to suffer. I'm going to let you know that I understand the blood, sweat, and tears of being human. And people deeply identify with a leader like that. I was working with a company the other day, 2 months ago, and they had this gap between the executive and then the management and the hourlies, and it was really this kind of like, they don't get us, we don't get them. It's really horrible. And I told the CEO, I said, they think that you think that you're bulletproof. And he said, I'm not, I'm a real guy. I said, I know, you are a real guy. You're not proud, but you're not conveying this. As they say in marketing, perception is reality. You may be a good guy, but they're not getting it. And you have a responsibility, they see that. And he said, what do I do? I said, well, we can do it kind of an easy way or the hard way. And he goes, well, what's the hard way? I said, let me tell you, the easy way is to get up and say, guys, sometimes I don't get it right, and it's been my fault that, you know, we don't have the numbers we have, and I'm sorry about that, and I want to do better. And that's pretty good. That's pretty vulnerable. But I knew he was like a college athlete, so I knew if I said the hard way, I knew which way he would go. I really manipulated him, actually. He said, what's the hard way? Okay, I'll tell you. As you talk about your childhood up here and why you're here, because I knew his story. He goes, that's what I'm going to do. I said, okay, I wasn't thinking about it, but sure. He gets up there at his team meeting and says, we're not vulnerable, and I'm the worst at this, and I have been conveying it, and I want to tell you something. I started this company because my family didn't work. I was in a family business, and I didn't feel close to my family, and I felt a lot of performance issues. I didn't feel accepted, and it was miserable, and I wanted to go where people would be nice to me. Because I had a really tough family, and that's why I'm here. I picked all of you guys because I needed a family. And I'm sorry that I haven't let you know that. And it really got emotional. Like he's up there saying, there's this guy who's so successful. It's a billion-dollar company. And he's saying, I need you guys. And I came from failure. And I get lonely for relationship. Imagine for a second you had been in that conference room. There's 20 people. And you've been one of those 20 people. And you thought you were just going to talk about, what are you going to do today? Hit it hard. Got to take the hill. What's the challenges? And your top person says that. How would you have felt about your own needs to be vulnerable and open and honest and authentic? How would you have felt? I would have felt safer. I would have felt like, maybe this place is okay. Maybe if I admit a need or a failure or a need, somebody's not going to judge me or beat me up or condemn me. Maybe somebody will be nice to me. And so next time I'm going to open up. And that's exactly what happened in this corporation. People started saying, me too. I got that. Can I talk about me a little bit? And all of a sudden, things began to change. I'm not putting that as a prescription. Because I think there's a real problem sometimes in churches in getting talking too much about our deeper personal issues from the pulpit or from... And pulpit's okay because it's a great illustration. My wife and I had a fight on the way here. We're not talking to each other. I get that. I like that. I like preachers who do that. But when you're having your strategic stuff, I've often found it's probably better to be professionally... Talk about your professional needs and your professional failures and not, you know... How was your weekend? My kid's on drugs. I'm not sure that that's... Some churches can do it. Some churches can't. I always leave a lot of room for that. But to actually say, I really haven't led you guys well. I've been checked out. I've been micromanaging. I've been inconsistent in my values. And I'm sorry. And I need more support here. That's the vulnerability we're talking about. Aspiration is number two. Identification is number one. The fourth one is what's called observable execution. And observable execution has to do with people need to see a leader leading. That's why an extrovert sort of has an easier time on number four than introvert, because extroverts are wired that you get your energy from, you know, kibitzing and talking. And introverts get their energy from what? Being alone and kind of recharging the battery and thinking and taking a walk, praying or whatever. So if you're an introvert by nature, you got to work harder on this. You can do it. It just takes a little more energy. But people need to see the leader leading, which means the leader needs to do rounds, basically, into everybody else's spaces. Now, here's the hard part is you guys are really busy. And I got some of my best friends are pastors, and goodness gracious, you've got your own emergencies, and people need counseling, and there's elder board problems and all that. You have to create dedicated time in your calendar, in your little Outlook calendar that we all have, and say, be visible. Be visible. Where you're taking initiative. See, some leaders will say, I don't get it. I've got an open door policy. And that is what we would call in my world a passive position. Because who's got to take the effort? The people. Well, what if they don't think you're safe, or they think you're too busy, or they think that you might, you know, be resentful because you're buried and they're codependent with you so they don't want to bother you? You take the initiative. Which means probably, I mean, the formula is something like how are many people that you direct? Some of you guys direct four people. Some of you guys direct too many people, like 15 people, which is unmanageable. But however many you have, make sure everybody gets a substantive conversation with you once a week where you took the initiative. They got to see you leading. Also, if you're sort of a quantitative person, you know, you love Excel spreadsheets, you love Google algorithms, you're really into metadata and big data and all that stuff. You know, where's your tendency going to be to spend your time? In front of a machine called your computer. I mean, And that's good stuff. You got to have the projections and the trend lines and where's the money and who got saved. You got to have all that. But even if that's your passion, your skill, if you're leading people, you got to. It's like if you're a Facebook addict, you got to shut down the Facebook. It's like if you're a TV addict or ESPN addict, you got to shut down that down and do what's hard to do. Get out there and you will find that people go, oh, I see them. They're coming to me. And all of a sudden you get all this information about how things are going. It's very, very, very helpful. And the last one is candor. People are really drawn to candor. Now, candor is sort of an interesting word. What do you understand candor to be? Straightforwardness, honesty, directness, forthrightness. And candor is basically the truth you give people to help them perform better. Leaders tell the truth so that things get better. What we're finding is that there's always this mixture of enough grace and enough truth that really motivate people. And that mixture is almost a chemical titration. Some people are too much grace and not enough truth, and that leads to like lack of respect or license or licentiousness. Some people are too much truth and not enough grace, and it leads to judgmentalism and people avoid you, so on and so forth. But candor is just very necessary. Very, very hard for a pastor to have candor for various reasons. One reason is because A lot of pastors understand the depth of people's brokenness. And it's just hard to, like, confront people or challenge people when you know their backgrounds and their family of origin issues and their hurt. And, like, I don't want to lay more burdens on people than they already have. It's just kind of a compassion thing. A second reason that we don't have candor is because we're really afraid of the feedback from it. You know, we sort of have a culture, you know, and I hate to say it, but I've been working in the church a long time. We have an entertainment church culture in our church. We didn't start this, but they come in and you didn't meet my needs and this sort of thing. And who's the band and which person's preaching and awful stuff like that instead of how do I come and serve? And so to have candor, I'm like, oh, gosh, what are you telling me to get rid of 90% of my people by being honest? And then another one is because a lot of us suffer with a thing that I call, in the technical world, in the world I come from, it's a word that you'll find very useful, fragilizing. Fragilizing. Fragilizing is to make someone fragile who's not fragile. To make someone brittle and breakable who's not really brittle and breakable. And people in the ministry fragilize up and down the river. Have you ever walked on eggshells around somebody? Now, some of you walk on eggshells around one or two people. They're just kind of like these reactive people, and oh my gosh, they're going to run out of the room crying, they're going to yell at me. And so you kind of walk around eggshells around those one or two people. Some of you are so messed up, you do it with everybody. You're a global fragilizer. You fragilize God and your dog and your kids and everyone. So it depends on what, you know, flavor. But we all fragilize to some extent. And the funny thing is, when you fragilize someone and you don't tell them things because you're afraid to upset them or whatever, you know what you're saying to them? I don't respect you. I don't respect that you're a functioning adult who can take hard truths and be challenged. I think you're a little girl, a little boy, and if you heard something difficult, you might have to be hospitalized. So I don't think you're a functioning adult. It's a term of disrespect. When you get rid of fragilizing and say, I'm not going to be mean, I'm going to be relational, I'm going to be face-to-face, but I'm going to tell you some very direct, candor things, you're saying, I really respect you. Because one of the functions, if you look at human development, one of the functions of an adult is that adults are what we would call resilient and adaptive. Adults are resilient and adaptive. And when I'm working with leaders, they're just kind of like, oh, no, but I don't want to discourage them. I don't want to, you know, take the mojo away. I don't want to, you know, take the air out of their balloon. I don't want to. They're already busy. And that's what we call fragilizing. And I'll prove it to you. I would assume that most of you guys are functioning adults. Should I assume that, Jim? Okay, Jim says that you're adults. So that's good. We're all adults here. In the last 30 days, has anybody told you no to anything. It could be anything from no to a bank giving you some money for a loan, you know, $1 million loan, to going to Burger King and they don't have French fries that day. I mean, major stuff, you know, because if you don't have French fries, you don't have a good day. So something minor where they say we're out of French fries, or something major, you can't have $1 million. Has anybody had somebody in the last 30 days tell them no? Raise your hand. How are you functioning? I don't get it. You're ambulatory, you're smiling, you're walking. What did you do when you were told no? Grown-ups can handle no. What did you do to handle it? There's different things we do when someone tells us no. Yeah.
I realize I have a different perspective.
I realize that a person's saying no, and I have a different perspective. And I was okay with the difference. Okay? Any salesman people here, or people in sales or negotiation? What do you guys with sales training do when you hear the word no? Do you cry and go to call your mother? Huh? Anybody here? Nobody know anybody in sales? Oh, you know somebody in sales? This friend of yours. How does your friend? She's praying for her friend right now. So what does your friend do when your friend hears no, who's in sales? She feels sad. And then after she feels sad, she looks forward to the very next deal, because that's how you're trained in sales. So some people go, I just realized we're separate. Some people go, something else coming. Anybody good at negotiation or pushing back or arguing? Or, oh my gosh, you're calling each other out. Like, you ask her. Seriously, ask her. Okay, you got called out. What do you do? I regroup. Or I do what Abraham did. What did Abraham do with God? You know, I'm going to blow everything up. What did Abraham say?
Yeah,
let's negotiate it down. Or let's try it another way. Is there a win-win here? And then sometimes you go, goodness gracious, you don't have French fries. I'm sorry. Well, I'll go have a salad. That's what adaptation and resilience are. So all of you actually survived a no. Give people in your church the respect of being just as adaptive as you. Don't fragilize. And I'll give you a story. excuse me. I have a leadership coaching program here, where I take people who want to be higher, who want to be high performers and be higher performers, through a holistic program of knowing themselves and knowing strategy and vision and mission, but also knowing the internal world. And one of my executives had 7 directs, and he had a 360 given to him. Everybody know what a 360 is? Somebody say what a 360 is. It's evaluation. And it's really valuable. We all like it now, but the research says, because you get honesty, because people anonymously evaluate who are lateral to you on the org chart, who are above you on the org chart, and below you. So you really get reality. It's very, very powerful. And he was the nicest guy in the world. He had 7 directs. And so, you know, he said, oh, I'm getting ready to have my 360. And I knew him, and I knew how much he loved his people. And, I mean, he knew the spouse's names, knew the kids' names, would go to the hospital, have burgers and fries with him in the backyard, the whole thing. I mean, really, really a great relational guy. He comes back, and he's devastated. I said, what's the matter? He says, I got really low scores. They didn't like my leadership. I said, well, I'm surprised, too. You need to do some research here. So go back and check it out and say, ask why I went wrong. So he goes and checks it out and comes back, and he said, this is amazing. I said, tell me. He said, I sat down with him, like all 7, and I said, I know this is anonymous, but I really got bad scores, and I need to know what this is about. I want to be a good leader. God's put me with you guys. And they kind of shuffled around and in a kind of awkward moment, and then finally one said, we don't trust you. It's blown away. What do you mean? Well, we don't trust you. Totally blown away. What do you mean you don't trust me? I know your spouse's names. I go to you. I affirm you. I'm the positive guy. I'm your cheerleader. Here's what we found out. He was that kind of guy that affirms the attaboys. Oh, you're going for it. You're it. I'm telling you, you're fourth member of the Trinity. You really are. And, you know, and we all got to have that, right? But if there was bad news and he was disappointed in performance or a bad attitude, or if there was triangulation and they were too political or they were late on everything or never got things done, I mean, strict performance stuff where they weren't meeting the standards, because everybody working for you needs to have standards. That's why it's work. Guess what he would do? He'd pull away. And he'd go gripe to one of his friends, and then the person that he was disappointed in would hear it from the friend, not directly from him. And they said, we trust you in the good stuff because you're very affirming, but we don't trust you with bad stuff. In my world, we call that the conflict avoidant leader. Highly conflict avoidant. Just was afraid of conflict. So I asked him, I said, well, is this true? He goes, it's true. And I said, this is a problem to your whole career. He says, I know. I said, do you want to go to work on it? He said, I have to go to work on this. So we began doing some very deep personal work. Guess what we found of this? At the bottom of this conflict avoidant, really smart, really high capacity, loving, great Christian values, at the bottom of all this was an alcoholic, abusive father. Who, every time this little boy would want to disagree or say, I don't like it when you yell, or I need to stay out later, or kind of push against dad, it wasn't a good experience. Now, if you look at developmental, you know, research, moms are kind of love and structure, and dads are kind of structure and love, and we all have to work it out. But a kid, a little boy or a little girl, needs to push against dad and say, I think you're unfair, or, you know, I need 14 cookies, not one cookie, or whatever we do. We got to push against dad. His mom was fine. She was kind of like okay with all that. But his dad, and a good dad should go, I know you want 14 cookies. Well, you're getting one. Have a nice day. You want to watch TV or play basketball? I mean, they can take the challenge and they metabolize it so the kid goes, okay, he still likes me and I didn't get what I wanted, but we're still friends. And the kid learns to challenge people in their lives, and then they say no to drugs, and they say no to moral disorders, and they say no to lots of bad things because they were able to wrestle with their father in the same way that Jacob wrestled with God, whose name changed to Israel. And what does the word Israel mean in the Hebrew? He who wrestles with God. God blessed him with that name. You wrestle. God blesses wrestle. He blesses challenge. Why do you think the Psalms are so full of angst and pain and David going, what are you doing? I'm in the cave and I'm the king. This isn't right. God blesses the challenge. That's not rebellion. That's challenge. He had a dad that really bad things would happen. So he learned instead to do end runs around people. Students, friends, dates, whatever. Instead of saying, I don't like what's going in between us, he learned to schmooze. Conflict avoidant leader. So he had to do a lot of very difficult, tough work. This is, by the way, this is why you guys need SIFT. Because Jim has created a culture for many, many years. I've been referring to Jim's groups for many years, where you'll get people that can deal with these sorts of issues in a thoroughly Christian manner, but they don't do the shallow stuff. They do the deep stuff. And he basically had to face his father again. Jim didn't. I mean, I'm changing stories here. It wasn't not about Jim. He had to face his father here and basically protest the sin, forgive, and then heal. Because all of us have to protest the sin, forgive, and heal. And it was hard work, and it worked. And so they did another EQ, 360 a few months later. Guess what happened to his scores? Went back up. People were now drawn to him, not just because he was a great affirmer, but he was a great challenger. You need both skills. Candor cannot be... candor's not an option. Candor's not an option. And sometimes in churches it'll be, well, the senior guy is the positive guy and the executive guy is the negative guy. How many executives we got here? Executive pastors. God bless you guys. You know what the job of the executive pastor is, right? Your job is to fulfill all the promises the senior guy makes from the pulpit. That's why they look so tired all the time. Like, what are you going to promise today? Okay. And a lot of times the church will kind of use that as a split, where the senior person's kind of positive, go for it, and the executive person's like, oh, I'm reality, I'm, you know, no. And that's awful. Every good church has got a senior pastor who is visionary and positive, but also says this doesn't work, as well as an executive who can actually be nice to people. Wouldn't that be something if you're an executive pastor? Pray for your executive pastors. I love executive pastors, and they get a hard job, right? But that's what candor is. People are drawn to that because then they trust it. And when they trust it, they grow. And when they grow, guess what happens? The high-performing ones of them become your leaders. And I'm not to be too obsessional about this, but you ought to always be on the hunt for your next leaders, because they're going to bring your job more efficiency, more effectiveness. They'll take over things so that you're left with the things you should be doing: correct teaching of the word, holding the vision, solving the problems they can't solve. All right? So, those are the big five. You got to start, though. You got to start with the first one, I think, which is warmth. And warmth doesn't mean spending all your time schmoozing and listening. And goodness gracious, don't be their counselor. I'm so glad Jim said that. Don't be their counselor. You be the conduit to the counseling. I know every pastor has got a counseling load, but if you're called to preach and teach and counsel and disciple and run things and also raise money and whatever and do stewardship stuff, you give them, you see yourself more as a conduit of the help they need. You'd be the bridge to all the help they need, but don't try to do it all yourself. There's a lot of resources out there that can help you. So, those are the big five. And they will draw people to you, and things should be good. So this kind of material sort of lends itself to questions. So we've got a few minutes for questions.